Today on Vox Talks, restoring India's financial stability. Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. A few weeks ago, I was speaking to Viral Acharya from NYU's Stern School about his research on European banks and their lending to zombie firms over the last decade. And then at the end of the interview, Viral pointed out to me that he's just publishing a book based on his time as Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank of India. So maybe, he suggested, we could talk about the evolution of and the prospects for India's financial sector and the lessons it offers for other emerging economies. And that's a very good idea. So Viral joins me again today. Welcome back to Vox Talks.
Thank you, Tim. It's my pleasure to be back.
This book brings together your speeches while you were deputy governor. How do you remember this when you look back on it? Are you sorry that time's over, or are you pleased to be out of it?
That's a good first question, Tim. I think it was a very enriching personal and professional experience. I think for someone like me who does research in financial economics, especially on banking sector regulation, systemic risk, financial crises, transmission of monetary policy, etc., there's probably no better role outside academia than being at a central bank. One learns a lot on the job because there's always a lot of country-specific issues as well as a lot of practical but important details that are sometimes glossed over in academic research. Second, policy making involves taking a very comprehensive or holistic view of the system rather than focusing on just each issue individually, as is often the case in publishing an academic paper where you go in a lot of depth on one issue. You need the depth in policy making as well, because that informs your intuition and helps you make good judgment calls. But you always need breadth to understand where are the spillovers, unintended consequences, and so on. And third, I would say it was quite special because we did try to lay down the foundations of financial stability in India for a decade, two decades or longer, if possible. Some of it is work in progress. Some of it remained as an unfinished agenda. Nevertheless, I'm very happy to have had the opportunity to do that important work for the country where I'm from.
Yes, and it is work in progress, isn't it? Because this is quite recent. Remind me again what dates you were in the job?
I joined in January 2017, Tim. I was on a three-year term. I finished 6 months early in July of 2019.
Even though the Reserve Bank of India looks to an outside observer like any independent inflation-targeting central bank, when you're reading the book, it becomes obvious that it is anything but that. So can you explain to us the structure of India's banking sector? It's not simple, is it?
Absolutely not, Tim. It's, as you point out, there are structural forces that make it hard for the central bank to remain entirely independent or at least autonomous in an operational sense. The book has an excellent foreword by former RBI Governor Dr. Y.V. Reddy, which gives a historical perspective on this issue. And he has this one beautiful sentence that the government, the central bank, and the public sector banks in India, so these are the banks that are owned by the government, they together form what is a Hindu undivided family where no one keeps each other's accounts. And that, in a way, sums up the core of the issue, at least until the last two decades, which is that India was a nationalized economy. The private sector was very small. Almost all the Indian banks had been nationalized in two waves in late 60s and 70s. And that created a financial system whose primary purpose was to enable the government to fund its deficit programs at a cheap cost. So the central bank was effectively engaged in very high levels of financial repression. At its peak, close to 40% of the deposits that went into a bank had to be by fiat put into government borrowing programs. And all this was cozy and okay because you were economically repressing the private sector as well. What has happened over the last two decades is that the economy, especially after the post-1991 liberalization reforms, has become more market-oriented. It has become more private sector focused because the country's demographics, growth aspirations, and the need to eradicate poverty, which is still at a high level, has meant that the old 3% Hindu growth rate of the nationalized India arrangement is no longer acceptable. Everyone realizes that we need a thriving private sector to deliver a higher than 3% growth rate. Now, what has happened is that for a short while, the growth was high. This was the pre-global financial crisis era. Growth was high. The household savings were increasing. And actually, several important reforms had put the government on a path of reducing its wasteful expenditures, so consolidating its debt to GDP numbers. And during that phase, I would say the central bank was evolving towards a central bank of the developed countries in the sense of having greater operational autonomy and independence. And this was very crucial because the letter of the law, which is the Reserve Bank of India Act, is very weak in protecting the central bank from it enjoying this operational autonomy. But in spite of that, the conditions were conducive up until about the global financial crisis, so say between 1991 to 2007-8. However, post-global financial crisis, growth weakened. The headwinds to global growth were also strong. The household savings rates declined. And gradually, the government found itself on a path of slippages as far as its fiscal deficits and debt to GDP targets were concerned. And as this happened, it has increasingly turned towards the central bank to relax its monetary policy, liquidity policy, bank regulations, accounting standards for loan losses, and so on, in order to get quick fix to generating a short-term boost to growth, either through its own expenditures, which are not always in the form of capital expenditures, but are more in the form of subsidies, or by creating a leverage boom through the banking sector. And this has meant a very pervasive pressure on the central banking policy. I referred to this in the introductory chapter of the book as fiscal dominance, which I call a theory of everything in India, because traditionally macroeconomists have viewed fiscal dominance, where the deficit and borrowing situation of the government starts dominating over the central bank policies, as one in which interest rate setting gets compromised, where the central bank keeps low rates and sidetracks its price stability or inflation objectives. In India, because the central bank is first of all an all-purpose central bank, it does the supervision, it regulates the banks, it performs the deposit insurance function and so on. The pressures on the central bank in India are across board, and it has in fact compromised the financial sector stability. A notable point being the question you asked, which is what is it in the structure of banks, which is that more than 50 to 60% of the assets and deposits are still with the public sector banking, and the pressure is always for the government to not have to inject capital in these banks so that they can continue with their high deficit and borrowing programs without having to actually put capital into banks. And so financial stability is now being compromised because undercapitalized banks don't lend well, they are risk averse, or they are trying to evergreen their bad loans, a form of zombie lending, which we discussed last time.
However, this government spending has a social purpose. It is also usually discussed as a way to boost growth. Are you saying that this fiscal dominance is reducing growth in India's economy?
Yes, Tim. And let me shed light on two aspects of it. First, the government borrowing programs are now so large that the total amount of dissaving by the government, how much they borrow, exceeds the net household savings in the economy. Which means that the corporate sector, which is also a dissaver, so it also needs to fund itself from outside, in an accounting sense in the aggregate, has no domestic borrowings left for it to borrow. So effectively on the margin, both the government and the corporate sector are reliant on external funds to actually continue with the consumption and the investments. So this creates a massive crowding out of the corporate sector. Their costs of borrowing can be high at times when the government supplies supply of paper is very large. And second, small, medium-sized enterprises are not even able to borrow internationally, and they face very, very high costs of borrowing domestically. Of course, this also applies to household credit, which potentially could also be cheaper, at least in the unsecured borrowing markets. The second point about this is that the question is, what is the composition of the government expenditure? More than 90% of the central government's expenditure in India is just revenue expenditure or, you know, subsidies and welfare programs. Less than 10%, and in fact, it's actually very close to just barely 5%, is on capital expenditures such as on infrastructure, health, and education. Now, what research has shown is that subsidies, of course, they boost the immediate growth number because they will get counted in the GDP calculations, but they don't crowd in private sector investments and they don't generate a long-run multiplier for growth. Whereas capital expenditures, especially investments in infrastructure, have been shown to generate long-term fiscal multipliers. So, because they also crowd in private investment, plus they enhance the productivity of the economy. At the state level, the expenditures are also lopsided, but not as much as the central government's expenditures. So, the states do between 20 to 25% on capital expenditures. Nevertheless, for a country where tremendous gains have to be made in ease of doing business on the ground, a lot more is required in terms of quality of roads, railways, ports, airports, etc. These are very low levels of investments in long-run growth of the economy. So the combination of low growth returns in a long-term sense on government expenditures, crowding out of the private sector investors and borrowers because the government is saving too much, and simultaneously weakening of the strength of the financial sector because the government is always turning to the central bank to relax the rules for financial stability so that it doesn't have to recapitalize the banks, means that the system is evolving to a low growth, low productivity, and weak financial system sort of a combination. And I think that could be a bad trap for the country to fall into.
So we have this habitual, traditional fiscal dominance in the Indian economy. It affects financial stability, it reduces growth, it has negative impacts for the private sector as well. What can we do about it? How do we fix the health of the banking sector, especially, as you say, these public sector banks?
Tim, my view is that we do need to address financial stability first and foremost, but the country now also requires deeper institutional reforms on the fiscal management side. Let me first talk about financial stability. I always say that when you invest in property, it's all about location, location, location. When you think about financial stability, it's always about capital, capital, capital. I think what is missing in the Indian financial system is that the system is always trying to catch up on the legacy losses it has made through provision of capital, rather than using capital as a buffer for taking on risk for new loans that are being made. So use capital as a growth capital rather than as one for absorbing past losses. And the system has got into this perpetual delayed cycle where it's never high on capital to lend well, especially on the public sector banking side. The private banks in India are now by and large well capitalized. They raise capital ahead of time because they face market discipline, unlike the public sector banks, where the implicit sovereign guarantee is very, very strong. How can this be done? I think it requires, in my view, adoption of stress tests, as has been done in the developed economies post the global financial crisis. This would enable the regulators to project stress and losses ahead of time, get banks to be well capitalized, so that even when losses occur, they have enough capital to continue their intermediation functions for healthy parts of the economy. I would say this is one of the most important pillars on financial stability that's required. Second, in India, regulation of banks is not ownership neutral. The presence of public sector banks is combined with the fact that the Bank Nationalization Act overrides the powers of the central bank in how to govern these banks. So the central bank has powers, for example, to dismiss management of private sector banks, sell their equity to another equity provider if the private bank is not raising the required levels of capital. Such important powers, which are required to promptly correct deterioration in the quality of a bank, are not available with the central bank as far as public sector banks are concerned. And this is a big crack in the regulatory architecture, in my view. It's almost a structural crack. You know, it weakens the entire edifice because this means you effectively have dual control. A part of the regulatory powers rest with the Department of Financial Services inside the Finance Ministry. And it's been very hard to get the public sector banks to raise capital in time, to have new management that is moving it forward in the right direction, and so on. And so I think that is a second very important legislative change that is required. And the third, I would say, is that India needs better disclosure of defaults by its borrowers. Indian debt contracts, typically the bank debt, recovers as little as 25 to 40 paisa on a rupee. This is about half of what would be the recovery on bank loans in developed countries, and it's lower than most other emerging markets as well. So as one of my former colleagues, former Deputy Governor Vishwanathan, used to say, that the Indian bank loan contract looks more like an equity contract rather than a debt contract. And that needs to be fixed. One way to do that is, of course, to have a time-bound insolvency and bankruptcy code that is resolving the assets in a timely manner. This has been put in place, but it needs to be allowed to function so that cases are promptly put there for resolution. And to do that, India needs better disclosure norms. When firms default for about 30 days, no one in the system actually knows that a firm has missed its payments and is not managing its cash flows well. And this has affected the entire ecosystem because even the quality of ratings provided by rating agencies is not as great as it could be. So I would say capital ownership, neutral regulation, including of public sector banks, and better default disclosure, especially on bank loans, could be three important pillars of financial stability going forward. As I said, I also think the country needs institutional reforms in the fiscal sector. And if there is time, I can touch upon my agenda for that side of overall macroeconomic stability.
Well, this is a good time to do it then.
So essentially, India has what are called as FRBM targets. This was a Fiscal Responsibility and Budget Management Act, which was passed in 2003, and then it had a review thereafter. It sets medium-term fiscal deficit and debt to GDP targets. Now, the governments have said that they are going to adhere to these targets, but by and large, they have slipped even in normal times, not just like in a year such as the one we are experiencing now in the midst of COVID. So India needs to improve adherence to these targets. And the question is how to do it. It has been recommended by several reform reports in the past that India needs to have an independent bipartisan fiscal council, a little bit like a congressional budget office, which would hold a mirror to the progress of the government on the FRBM targets. And it would vet every single budget that gets announced on an annual basis as to what the strategy of the government is and where the cash flows are going to come from. Right now, a lot of the budgets make extraordinary growth assumptions to justify any expenditure as being feasible, but an independent council would actually keep such impulses in check. I already touched upon the fact that the composition of fiscal expenditures in India is very tilted towards revenue expenditures which don't generate long-run growth multipliers, unlike capital expenditure. Perhaps the subsidies can be rationalized and rolled out instead as a single universal basic income, which simply goes as a direct cash transfer. India has now put in place a digital technology to make this possible with a unique identifier for most of its citizens. And the space that gets freed up as a result of these rationalization can be used to produce better infrastructure and invest in healthcare capacity and education and skilling of youth. These would be sort of long-run structural reforms that can bring about high fiscal multipliers. Fourth, the transparency of the fiscal accounts in India right now is not great. There's a lot of on-balance sheet and off-balance sheet shifting around of expenditures. Part of it has been motivated with this desire to show that there is official adherence to the FRBM targets, even though there has always been slippage on these once you take account of balance sheet vehicles of borrowing. These practices need to be reined in. India, as you know, and as I've been stressing, has a large presence of public sector enterprises, not just banks. And so their borrowings also ideally need to be consolidated to get a single number that used to be called as a public sector borrowing requirement. Right now, this number is not officially produced for India, but it needs to be produced so that it's transparent what is on balance sheet versus off balance sheet. Then the goalpost in terms of the medium-term FRBM targets becomes clear, and how much of a course correction is required, no one can deny it once that number is out there. And point five is that the government needs to reduce its reliance on borrowing. This can be achieved through a massive disinvestment program, through shedding of majority stakes, not just in public sector banks and public sector-owned insurance companies, but also in other non-strategic sectors. This would improve the efficiency of these firms, besides bringing in funding for the exchequer that's not in the form of debts that need to be repaid soon. Efficiency would come about because of better management practices, ability to hire better labor with better incentive schemes, better use of technology, governance, risk management, and so on. Some people view that such institutional reforms cannot be undertaken in the midst of a shock such as the pandemic. But the ground reality is that the government likely needs to make transfers to the poor who are most affected by the pandemic. As we know, the inequality is getting worse during the pandemic. However, the government's fiscal capacity is heavily limited at present, and it doesn't want to risk a rating downgrade because there isn't commitment to debt sustainability in the medium term. So in my view, the way to create space for the needed pandemic-related fiscal relief measures is to actually restore commitment and debt sustainability over the medium term. And this five-point institutional reform package for the FISC could be a way to strike that compromise. You undertake the necessary expenditures, but you keep the rating agencies, investors, and markets comfortable that when growth returns, the country will actually be on a sustainable debt path.
Well, Vero, you've just spent a couple of years in the room with the sort of people that could drive these reforms through. Is there any chance they're going to happen?
I tend to remain hopeful always, Tim, for the simple reason that episodes such as global financial crisis or COVID very often align the politics and the economics. Sometimes deeper structural reforms are hard to undertake because it's easy for the political economy to coast along well in normal times without actually doing much. Small growth shocks can be absorbed here and there through some patchwork. But when you have a large growth shock, such as our balance of payments crisis in 1991 or a global financial crisis with tremendous headwinds to global growth and trade, or COVID, which has not just on health front, but even on economic front, resulted in severe disruptions in India, like in many other countries, does create a window of opportunity where doing the right thing is also what is immediately required for the government. And it is this, for the wrong reasons, we are in that situation. And therefore, I remain hopeful that the institutional fiscal reforms, as well as at least some of the difficult financial stability reforms, are brought on or put back on track, because that's the only way to come out of the COVID situation relatively, I would say not entirely, but relatively unscathed.
Is this mix of problems unique to India, or are there lessons from India's experience for other emerging economies here?
That's a great question, Tim. I would say perhaps there are lessons not just for emerging markets. Increasingly, I tend to think that the nature of politics, the populism, the pressures on the central bank and the banking sectors to create short-term impulses of growth coming from the authorities are gradually becoming the norm, even in the developed economies. As we know, post-global financial crisis, growth has been difficult to generate easily. We managed to create a lot of household credit-based growth in developed markets prior to that, but that went bust. And now there's increasing pressure on the central banks to maintain very easy accommodative conditions. There's pressure on the central banks to help monetize government borrowing programs. Think about Bank of Japan or European Central Bank's extraordinary quantitative easing measures. Clearly, in case of ECB, it looks like a quasi-fiscal action to support the periphery countries' sovereign debt programs, where deeper structural reforms really haven't taken place in some cases. So my view is that the experience that India has had, not just pre-90s, where it was a nationalized economy, but also post-90s, where in spite of gradually moving towards a market economy, when the conditions are not right, these pressures start simmering and building up again, potentially weakening growth and financial stability. I think this could actually be an interesting thing to watch out in developed markets as well. And why do I say this? Because the fiscal deficits and debt to GDP numbers are only rising upward since the global financial crisis. There has not been much consolidation of the developed economy sovereign balance sheets. And if growth is not back on track smoothly, and as many people say, there will be some scars because a lot of productive capacity is reorienting itself from old sectors to the new sectors, and COVID has sort of accelerated that in a very short period of time. If that doesn't happen, not for all, but definitely for some developed markets, debt sustainability concerns could be on the horizon. What will they do in those times? Will they undertake deeper structural reforms? Will they undertake institutional fiscal reforms? Or will they lean on their central banks and banking systems to repress the private sectors, to keep interest rates low, allow runaway inflation to take hold, and possibly weaken macroeconomic stability? I think these are likely to be questions that developed economies will grapple with as well. And I believe that India's experience, one that I have recounted in the book, especially in the first chapter on fiscal dominance, but also on how it's hard to deal with banking crises with a fiscally stretched government, how it is hard to strike the right balance between the government, the central bank, the markets, and the private sector in a fiscally stretched macro scenario. I think these sorts of discussions from my book might be relevant increasingly so for developed economies as well.
They're a very important question, so thank you very much for coming in again.
Thanks a lot, Tim, and have a lovely day.
Vira's book, as I mentioned, brings together the speeches that he made while in post, and it really is a guide to both the science and the art of central banking. It's called Quest for Restoring Financial Stability in India, and it's published by Sage India. And don't forget to also look up our recent Vox Talk, which dealt with Europe, and that was called Europe's Zombie Lending. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the most innovative economic research every week, so subscribe to Vox Talks, you never miss an episode. And remember, there's 10 years of Vox Talks at voxeu.org/vox-talks.